Hey, welcome to the Long Form. Wow, that's a loud dog over there. That's a breathy dog. Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. Wow, Reba is riled up for 2015.
Reba is excited for the new year.
Yeah, she heard about the sponsors and the guests we have coming up, and she's wild. Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with my co-hosts Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Good morning, fellas.
Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been exciting.
New year, 2015.
Evan, you look like you woke up in like a dryer.
The first day of the new year is always the most difficult, right?
Yeah, it was hard getting out of bed today.
Yeah. I've been sleeping. I'm like so stocked up now. I could just go for like 3 days. Yeah, I bought the. Thanks. This is an unpaid plug. Unpaid. Good people over there at EA. Who usually supply us with the video games for the FIFA soccer, sent me the Dragon Age video game, which I've just been playing like 12 hours a day. So thanks to EA.
Did you beat it?
Oh, I'm like in the like first level still. I have like 100 hours left.
When you're not playing that video game, who were you talking to?
I talked to Nicholas Carlson from Business Insider. You probably have seen, if you know his name, he's written these like really, really deeply researched pieces about, I think he's covered pretty much all of the tech giants. He recently had actually a Times Magazine cover story about Marissa Mayer and Yahoo, which is actually adapted from his book. And he's also covered Facebook and Apple and Google
and AOL. That Tim Armstrong piece is amazing.
Yes, actually, that was the one I was thinking of, was the AOL one. And he's I think his writing is really interesting because I don't understand how anyone talks to him within these companies. Like, I feel like just being seen in his presence would be grounds for being fired. But I wouldn't say his stories are praising or hit pieces. They walk this fine line and really get you deep into how these companies work from a business and a creative level.
All right. Balanced journalism. Balanced. Who would have thunk it?
Hey.
It's 2015. I believe we have some new sponsors in 2015.
Yes.
We have one specific new sponsor. Aaron,
Lynda.com. That's Lynda, LYNDA.com. Lynda.com is a place where you can go for training videos. They're really well done. You can learn anything from HTML to CSS to how to podcast with GarageBand. Pretty much if there's any skill that you're looking to pick up on a computer in 2015, you've got a New Year's resolution to finally make that personal site for your photography, what have you. I really recommend Lynda.com as a place to do it. You can get a free 10-day trial, which gives you access to all of their videos by going to Lynda, LYNDA.com/longform. Unlimited access, even on the iPhone, Android, wherever. Go check it out.
If you don't want to learn how to build a website, just want to make it super easy, you can use Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform. It's called Squarespace 7. It's completely redesigned. It's way simpler to use. You've got Getty Images and Google Apps. There's 15 new templates. They've got an incredible new feature called Cover Pages. You can go try the new Squarespace right now, squarespace.com. Use the code LONGFORM at checkout. You'll get 10% off.
Let's say you make a website, whatever means you might choose to make it.
Either way.
And then you got a website, then you're maybe producing some work, maybe you're blogging, and then you want to tell people about it.
What would you do?
You got to make an email newsletter. It's 2015. It's not 2000. You got an email newsletter. That's how people do it now, and you should use Tiny Letter. It's made by MailChimp. Everybody who makes an email newsletter, as far as I can tell, is using it as they should, and we thank them for their sponsorship.
Wow. Evan, did you take the Lynda.com course in pitching? Because you are a new man.
One of my resolutions for the new year
is
to be a stronger participant.
Did you go to pitch
in
camp?
This part of the podcast.
Wow. Thanks.
You were really thinking about that?
No. See how I did it right there?
Yeah, that was good. It's been a good break for you, I think.
Yeah.
Here's Aaron and Nick Carlson.
Welcome, Nicholas Carlson.
Hello. Hi.
Where are you coming from?
I just came from work, Business Insider.
So you tend to focus on these like sprawling, massive stories that are kind of like the rise and fall of an entire company, but you're actually at Business Insider day to day, sitting at a desk.
That's right. Yeah, it's a day job. I've been there 6 years.
6 years. Wow. Okay. So I know that you also will do, you know, nine reasons why this stock is not quite that, but you mix it in with some shorter stuff. What did you get hired as 6 years ago at Business
Insider? So I was at Valley Wag back when Owen Thomas was the editor, and then 2008 came.
So Valley Wag, for people listening, is Gawker Media's Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley Gossip Rag.
Gossip Rag, yes, exactly.
That's what it's called. Yeah, it was what it's called back then.
Yeah.
I was the Alleywag for Valley Wag.
Okay.
Because it was Silicon Alley, which is just the worst pun ever. But
what is that, like 23rd Street kind of?
Exactly. I mean, yeah. I think it's just the New York name of the tech scene that came around basically back in the 90s. Anyway, so yeah, I was the Alleywag.
So did you have like an ambition to become a technology reporter?
No.
Oh. Well, no. What were you thinking you were going to move to New York?
In college, I did a lot of writing in high school. And I was going to become a world famous short story writer.
Yes.
And novelist.
It's not too late.
Right. Still on the way. But I was going to write short stories at night or in the morning, very early in the morning, and have a day job. And so out of school, I went to Merrill Lynch and I was a client associate, which is like a nice sounding name for a glorified secretary. I did a lot of helping people roll over their 401ks and I hated it. It was terrible.
So like, is this the kind of like we've had Kevin Roos on this show and he did the book that's kind of like, you know, a year in the life of a Goldman Sachs first year or whatever. Is it like a cutthroat kind of job?
No. So those guys, I think, are making, I'm just guessing, you know, I don't know.
$200,000
right,
a year.
Yeah, I was making 33.
Oh,
so,
wow.
No, this was like you had to have a high school degree to have this job. And by the way, there are people who do this job and are great at it.
Yeah.
It wasn't really for me. I was surrounded by people who just had different, not bad, but just different interests than I had. And I was like, how am I ever going to make friends in New York? it was just very different. And I kind of quickly realized that to write, I just, for good or bad, I need to be incentivized by money.
Yeah.
You know, I just has to be a job. I can't do things on spec. Not really. I'm not good at that. And so I went out and I applied for as many journalism jobs as I could find on journalismjobs.com and Media Bistro. And I just cold emailed 200 or so.
So did you have any journalism experience at this point?
No, I mean, I wrote a column for my college newspaper.
Okay.
So good point.
Yeah. what was the column?
The column was just the thoughts. I think, what did I call it? I can't even remember. It's just on like how hard it is to date at Davidson, or that's where I went to school.
So you had no journalism experience.
None.
You went on journalismjobs.com, which is the logical move when you have no journalism experience. And like out of 200, out of all those applications, how many interviews did you get?
I got two interviews.
Oh, wow.
One was with Chain Store Age, and it was a magazine that covers chain stores. And one of the interview questions is, what do you think about Walmart? And the answer, the right answer for them was, Walmart's an amazing company and, you know, they're doing incredible things. But anyway, I did a writing test for them. And ultimately, the editor-in-chief said that, you know, I just didn't have a journalism degree, so she couldn't hire me. And that job would have paid $25,000 a year. So, and I would have taken it. And then the second interview I got was at internetnews.com. And that's how sort of I started writing about technology. It was the place that was
internet.
Hired.
I'm not familiar with internetnews.
Yeah, no,
I feel
no
like
internetnews.com
is like in a movie. You're like the version of you in the movie works at internetnews.com.
Yeah.
It's also, I think, kind of ballsy to have internet in the name of your website.
Well, it's a very .com on the nose name.
What is internet news? I'm almost inclined to sort of pull up the browser here and look at what internetnews.com is up to. What were your responsibilities
right,
at
internet
news?
So it was kind of, okay, so internet news actually, internetnews.com.
Does it have a dash between internet and news?
It does not. It's just internet news.
That would be, I don't feel like that would be even better if it was internet-news.com.
Well, you can tell it's old because you have to say .com when you say the name.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
There it is. But it looked like, different. It was more gray and smaller.
You're saying that this is post-redesign internet
yes,
news?
Yes, that is a redesigned internetnews.com.
I usually don't like to insult publishers on here, but
well, see, it's real-time IT news. And so this is a true business-to-business publication. It is news for IT managers.
Okay.
So it is for those people, and they sell ads against that. And those people make all the buying decisions about which.
This probably actually gets, they probably get like crazy good ad premiums on exactly. This actually is probably a very good business.
It was, a, it was a, yeah. I mean, they got like $100 CPMs or something, which anybody out there who knows the ad market knows that's crazy high. I mean, they didn't have traffic, but you know, they had conferences and things like that. And so they hired me. When they hired me, they're like, listen, you can cover all these little companies that no one cares about. You know, Google, Facebook, whatever that is, you know? And yeah. I was like, well, those are the ones I've heard of and that are cool. So thank you very much. I will cover them.
So how did you approach what's Facebook for the IT professional?
Yeah, no, I just ignored that.
Okay.
Yeah, I just wrote news stories about them. I wrote it from a business perspective. I think I was always interested. I mean, and that was good. They allowed me to sort of, you know, just talk about them as businesses.
So like of all of the, I would say the majority of the writers we have on the show are kind of like general interest or like people who are just kind of like after a story, not a beat.
Right.
And I find among beats, like the business beat, it's an elusive fox.
Yeah.
It has a language to it and it has sort of some assumptions about the role of business in society.
Yeah.
And it always feels to me like it's fighting against being a, like the press release looms large in its life. So, as you've gone through those first couple of years, like what do you learn on the first year on the job reporting on business?
Well, I mean, you learn the difference between revenues and profit and what, you know, I learned a lot. I was an English major at Davidson.
Yeah.
So, I talked about business around the house just because my, you know, and this is how I got the Merrill Lynch job. My dad works at Merrill Lynch.
Uh-huh.
So we would talk a little bit about business and the Wall Street Journal was his paper. So I, you know, knew a little bit about it, but I learned a ton. I learned a ton about journalism too. I think a huge advantage of internet news was that
.com
was that they did not believe in linking. It was so pre-internet that it was so like web 1.0 or web.
What was their objection to linking?
Because linking in it's hard to remember this, but early on people thought linking was bad because it meant that you were sending people off of your site and they should just be staying on your site all day.
Did they object to internal linking also?
No, they loved that.
Internal linking.
Because that was, good for all sorts of things. But they also had journalistic objection to linking, which was that they, now in the BIs like this, if the New York Times writes something, and it's worth passing on to our readers or, I want to cite a source. I can just link to a reputable brand or.
Well, also sometimes you'll have like a phrase in a story like outrage, like in the press or something like that. And it's like you kind of have to like link to that.
Right.
You can't just be like, trust me on this one. Like people were pissed. It's almost like footnotes are kind of the only the only way you can
get
around
that. But it was good for me in that if Google floated a news story in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and everyone else would just sort of take off on the story that was written, I had to call, they made me call Google and email Google and get the news from them, like straight from the horse's mouth or else it didn't happen.
Right.
We don't trust other publications.
Right.
And that was good because I got used to calling people and getting news and things like that. And I just, I think that a lot of people don't do that as much.
What's it like calling Google? As like a, first year, like it strikes.
When you're 24 or 23. How old was I? Well, there's like 22 or
23. 22, 23. I
wonder. I wonder.
We'll get to this later, but I was looking at a piece that you're going to have running next week in the New York Times magazine.
Right.
That's an adaptation of your book. If you're listening to this, it's out.
It's
check
out.
It out.
And Nicholas also, Carlson, by the way, it's public that I'm having a kid.
So. Oh, hey. Wow.
There you go.
Is that an exclusive?
That is a total exclusive.
So you're having a kid and you have a Times Magazine piece out right now.
That's fun to say. I haven't been able to tell
you
anyone.
You haven't been able to tell anyone?
No.
All right. Wow.
Yeah, there you go.
This is the most heartwarming thing that's ever happened on this podcast. So when I was looking through this Times Magazine, and it's basically like every time there's a pointed statement about something someone did, it's like rebuttal TK.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing like the first few times you're calling Google, you're calling Apple,
You're
not going to like stand up to someone and say, hey, we're publishing this. Like you can give your statement, but like we're sticking by.
When you're 22 and you're covering these things, you're you talked about the press release before.
Yeah.
You're covering the press releases. And the most aggressive you get with these companies, and it is sort of aggressive, is you go as a 22-year-old and you interview an analyst who has an opinion that the company is doing something stupid.
Right. You're not like old enough to have your own full of shit opinion, so you have to like go to an analyst for their full of shit opinion.
Exactly.
Kind of. Right. And you can't criticize the full of shit
right.
company.
And you're also not breaking news.
Right.
Or you're not reporting anything that the company doesn't want you to report because you don't have sources yet at 22 or
right.
23.
So when you look at a press release,
yeah.
like some press releases are just clearly bullshit.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm assuming now, like, at the station you're at now,
yeah.
you don't take you're unlike if something can just simply be contained in the press release, it's sort of not a story,
right?
Well, or it's just a post.
I do this because it's hopefully helpful, but there's a luncheon that a guy named Peter Himmler throws where business journalists get sit at a table and talk to a whole room full of PR people. And what I told the room full of PR people is, what you think is news is not news. You know,
right.
it's an announcement. Announcements are not news.
Right.
No one cares. No one cares. So I can't remember the last time I did a story based on a press release other than maybe like a major merger.
So at what point in your writing career did you do the first story that was not based on a press release
right.
or based on an announcement that the company would want to, something people wanted to parrot?
Yeah.
Out?
I mean, I think probably a year in. I mean, I'm just guessing, but I remember, you know, not to like, here's why I'm great, but no, but here's one thing that always has been an advantage for me is that I didn't get into this because I love technology or I love business. I got into it because I love writing. And so eventually, like, you're kind of boxed into a corner and you of like technology and writing, and you, okay, so I'll start reading about it and writing about it and start getting curious about it. So eventually I started to get curious and I said, do you remember when Viacom sued Google over YouTube?
Yes.
Yeah. So that was one time where one of the first times I really pissed off a PR person, but I didn't do it on purpose. But I went to Viacom and I sat, and the PR person, I think, put me, a 23-year-old, sat me down with, I think, the general counsel for Viacom, and he explained to me why they're suing Google. And that was all my idea. I was like, let's, you know, I try to report it out and all that. And so he told me the whole thing. And, you know, it was on background. And to me, on background at that time meant I just don't quote you.
Right.
But I can say where I got the information. And by the way, so, you know, if anybody's wondering, now I make this very clear with all sources, and it's all above board. But they
I don't know anything about business.
All these
reporting.
Things are made up.
On background is like, don't quote me, but take my information.
Yeah. So on background, and like it goes on and on. There's on background. There's on, obviously there's on the record, and then there's on deep background, and then there's off the record.
Uh huh.
On background, to me, usually means, it means the same thing as on deep background, by the way. But I'll say on deep background to make people even more comfortable.
You know, this whole show is on deep background.
it's all in what you mean by it. So,
okay.
So what I do is I'll explain to a source, when I say on deep background or on background, what I mean is that I can use the information you're giving me, but I won't say where I got it.
Uh-huh.
Or I'll get more nuanced and say, we'll agree to say, describe who you are generally.
Right. But so. Okay, I'm going to keep asking these questions.
Yeah.
We're going to go linearly through your history, and then I'm just going to get confused repeatedly.
Excellent.
Doesn't a good detective fairly easily figure out where you got that information? I mean, do you throw smoke screens on that deep background where you make it look like someone else?
It's all about a lot of things. It's about plausible deniability is a big part of it. You know, I noticed this a couple of years ago when I was reading James Stewart's Disney War.
Yeah.
And he talks about dialogue. Where does dialogue come from? And he said, I would caution the reader, and I borrow that phrase. I caution the reader from sort of just assuming that dialogue comes directly from the person speaking it.
Right.
I think he even says, or even is in the room, because people often relay conversations and so on and so on and so on. So dialogue and thoughts and things that happened can be triangulated and passed on and corroborated. I can write the story saying, like, this happened in this room and this person said this to that person.
Mm-hmm.
But neither one of those people talked to me. And that's, you know, it's hard to get into specifics about how that happens, but it happens, you know, all the time.
Hey, it's your host with a quick word from our sponsor, Lynda.com. Lynda is a site where you can get these training videos on just about anything. They have over 3,000 courses on topics like web development, photography, visual design, business. You can learn Excel, WordPress, and Photoshop, or you could learn
podcasting with GarageBand. So if in your 2015 you'd like to pick up some new skills for your job, for your hobby, for your art, whatever you're interested in developing, lynda.com has you covered. You can sign up for a free 10-day trial by visiting lynda.com/longform. You'll get unlimited access to every course on lynda.com. You can view them on your phone, Android, tablet, wherever, and there'll be new courses popping up every week. I checked out their offerings. Here are some ones I definitely want to take. Podcasting with GarageBand, JavaScript for web designers. God, my coworkers would love it if I would take that course. Creating websites with HTML5. So go do something good for yourself in 2015 and sign up for the free 10-day trial by visiting lynda.com/longform. You are sure to learn something valuable. Our next sponsor is a return sponsor and one of my favorites, Squarespace. They're a make-your-own website site that just got even better with Squarespace 7. You can remember back in the day, it was very hard to put up a website. You could change one link and break everything. Now when my friends want a website, I just refer them straight to Squarespace. And with Squarespace 7, they can do even more. They have a redesigned user interface, integration with Google Apps, lots of new design templates, including a partnership with Getty Images that gets you 40 million high-quality photos for your site. If you're interested in Squarespace 7 and how it works, you can go to squarespace.com/7. But I'll tell you about the core features of Squarespace that make it great day in and day out. 24/7 support via live chat and email, beautiful design, and only $8 a month, which includes a free domain if you buy a year. Plus, every site comes with a free online store, so you could do anything from a personal portfolio to e-commerce. Whatever you want to do on the web, Squarespace has you covered. So I want you to go to squarespace.com and put in offer code LONGFORM. You'll get 10% off your first purchase and show support for this show. That's promo code LONGFORM, Squarespace. Start here, go anywhere. Thanks, Squarespace. Here I am back with Nicholas Carlson. Okay, you've got your spectrum from on record to off record with like several depth charges along the way. Like when if I were looked at your notes for a story, like do you have like a record, off record, deep background stuff? I mean, like has anyone ever said
simpler than that? Generally an entire interview will be on the record.
Yeah.
I discourage people from talking to me on off the record. Because what good does that do? Off the record is a great spot where someone can lie to you because there's no consequences. Someone says, well, off the record, I say, just stop. I'd rather not know. Just, you know, don't talk anymore.
So, like, do you record conversations in this context?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, often with, you know, knowledge and...
You're starting to get stories that are a little more nuanced than the press release going in your career.
Yep.
At what point did you move over to Business Insider?
I was at internetnews.com .com for a year and a half. And Corey, I always get his last name wrong. Sicha?
I was going to say Sika, but I think it's Sicha, maybe. Sicha. Check out his long form podcast.
Posted an opening at Gawker. And I said, that looks like more fun.
Yeah.
And I wrote an email to Corey, and he said, you're more for ValleyWag. So he put me in touch with Owen Thomas, who was then running ValleyWag, and we had a drink, and then Owen hired me. And that was 2007.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun.
I read ValleyWag now, but I don't know that I read it then. Did it have the sort of confrontational reputation?
It was confrontational, yes. And the reason why, when 2008 happened and Nick Denton looked at costs and thought the world was ending, he fired ValleyWag first, everybody from ValleyWag first, was because it didn't sell ads. Because it's a gossip rag. And now now it's sort of in transition again. They hired Dan Lyons. But what it had been for the past 2 years, you know, currently, is more of like, I feel like an opinion section.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is like, you know, polemics on like what it means to be in this age with all these crazy billionaires in Silicon Valley. Whereas back then it was more of like a fun trade publication. It covered earnings.
I always have the impression, like with ValleyWag, that at least in the Sam Biddle era, check out his long form podcast, that it was like
the audience was actually mostly people who hate Sam Biddle. Like, it was like, it's all a bunch of, like, I imagine the traffic is centered around San Francisco.
Yeah.
And that it's like the people who are the most worried about it are reading it. Because you talk to anyone in technology, yeah, they read Sam Biddle, yeah, and hate Sam Biddle. Mm. And I don't know who, like, I don't know that many other people, like, I read it because I'm sort of interested in all this stuff and I think it's, like, fun. But it's, like, it's a pretty narrow band.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even really the whole tech. It's only, like, really the, like, ostentatious technology, yeah, industry that's covered.
Well, you know what people, the phrase I hear over and over, I heard it back then, is that ValleyWag serves a purpose.
Yeah.
You know, because it's such a hyped up industry.
Right.
That he just comes in and just hates everything. And so, you know. Although, I mean, ValleyWag was different back then, and you know, it was more of like a, it was more like the Page Six for technology,
right?
You know, like it was reporting on like the new It Couple.
And so, at that point, even though the reputation was less incendiary towards the industry,
yeah,
you're still talking about a Nick, yeah, Denton come on the show, Nick, publication.
Yeah.
And were you concerned that like you were never going to get like a legit straight job in technology
naively,
reporting again?
Naively, yeah. No. I was not concerned about that. I should have been.
Yeah.
Because I've spent the past 6 years of Business Insider repairing 1 year of like...
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I think it's not an issue anymore. It surprises me sometimes when I sit back and think, oh, I don't have to, like, people are okay with me.
So do people, in the year after that year, yeah, were people like, yeah, oh, Nick Carlson of ValleyWag?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, my boss, Henry Blodgett, got a lot of flack for hiring me.
What were the things that you did at ValleyWag that pissed people off?
You know, I was just following orders. I did some embarrassing things. It was actually sort of hard on your soul. I mean, you know, you'd like write about someone's, you know, extramarital affair, you know?
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
You know, one thing I did like, though, is just the aggressive. Whereas, like, Sam Biddle is aggressive against the culture of Silicon Valley, we are aggressive with the companies. Like, this is a bad decision you're making. Whereas, right, like, everyone's just cheering on every decision, little, you know, so.
So when you're in that situation, you're, what, 24, 25 years, yeah, old. I don't know which era of Gawker we're talking about, but depending on the era, like, potentially your paycheck is actually directly linked to page views.
I broke the page view system.
Oh, really?
Little known fact about me.
What was one story that did it?
Yeah, yeah. So the summer of 2008, Nick Denton switched it. Maybe he switched it at that beginning of that year. I think he did. To you get paid CPM for extra traffic. And
yeah,
I published a really really safe story called like the coolest workplaces in tech.
Yeah.
And it just had pictures of really cool workplaces all over the world of tech. And I made $15,000 that month, in 1 month, and then Nick turned it off.
So where I was going with that, which unfortunately the example does not correspond with, is that you're 24, 25 years old, and the way you can make enough money to live in New York,
yeah,
and potentially like, you know, not share a bathroom, yeah, anymore,
right,
is probably to be as aggressive as, and you know, the soul
right,
damaging part.
Yeah.
Those are linked to each other.
Yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
Well, a couple of things. So it wasn't just like the content. It was also the velocity. I went to Gawker and I wanted to make $50,000 a year. I felt like that was, you know, livable. And that meant I'd write 14 posts a day.
14 posts 14, a day.
14 posts a day. So that's, you know, $12 a post.
Yeah.
I think the math checks out. So that was 7 before lunch and 7 after.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a good thing and a bad thing. The quality obviously isn't always extremely high, but you do get this sense of like, I don't have writer's block at all.
Right.
I mean, like it just snapped it out of me.
Yeah.
You know, so you just like, oh, that's a story. That's a story. That's a story. That's
and
a story.
And do you start like systematizing it where you get like a routine going for the generation of posts?
Yeah. I mean, like, definitely. You wake up and you have things you read and then I just remember having like, you know, like a tab used to mean a story.
Yeah.
You know, like I would have like 7 tabs open for my morning.
So like the majority of those, and I'm reducing like a actually fairly complex issue in how reporting works now, but like the majority of those, if you're gonna do 14 posts a day,
yeah,
obviously no original reporting.
Yeah.
You're basically reposting other posts kind of like with your own voice or your own slant,
yeah,
on
well,
that.
Well, actually, I mean, what I started to try to do, so that would be really boring. I did look around and sort of say like, I'm not a writer for to be bored.
Yeah.
You know, not for the money either. So it's sort of like, so I started, you know, this is very simple stuff. Instead of just taking the one story and rewriting that, You take the one story and a name from it, and you Google that name and see what comes up and see what happened, you know, 5 years ago, and work that into the story and just sort of do this like Google reporting. Also, you just learn to email report, like just fire off emails all the time. By the way, when you get an email back from a source, that's just as good as a tab. So, I mean, it's, you know, in the sense of like you almost start to blog your sources, if that makes sense.
Okay, so this is probably the first time you're like really cultivating. So like for someone who's starting off in technology and business reporting, you're starting with zero sources.
Yeah.
You're playing the board game of tech reporting.
Yeah.
Who's your first source? How do you start developing?
I just had a conference with Sam Colt from Business Insider. I think he'd be fine with me saying this. We were talking about this today. Go to a conference and you look at the agenda and you see who is on at all worthwhile you knowing and that's speaking on any kind of panel.
Yeah.
You stand in the room and you wait till the panel's over and then the person gets off stage and you're the annoying one who goes up and introduces yourself to them. And you say, I know nothing about your industry. I'm covering it. I'm just trying to learn a lot. Can I, you know, bug you sometime for some help? Mm-hmm. You know, I need to know, you know, I don't. And very helpful posture as a reporter to be that way. And you say, and they say yes, because people love helping and you start to meet people that way.
Okay, so I'm Aaron Lammer of internetworld.com. We make internet products.
Yeah.
And you approached me after a conference and said, I'd love to have you as a source.
I don't say I'd love to have you as a source.
Oh, okay. So you're just like, I'd love to know more about your industry.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's our first interaction like?
You talk a lot.
Okay.
I ask you a few questions.
So I'm like, you know, it's so hard selling internet products. It's very stressful. My wife, my kids, my dog.
No, you talk less about your wife and your kids and more about your competitors.
Okay. They're full of shit. They're underhanded.
What you guys are doing great. And
they may have fudged some numbers on their report.
That guy over there is an idiot. That's a terrible strategy. And actually, by the way, that's how you get to know anything. Is like you listen to people who know something and you start to parrot them. You know,
you
decide what makes sense that you'd like to repeat, and so you do.
And then later, would I become a source potentially?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I really work, the way I work is, you know, like I have connectors. Like, so I have a few people in my, not Rolodex, but, you know, like maybe like a dozen or maybe a two dozen people. I know, you know, hundreds of people in the industry, but I know maybe two dozen people who are for some reason or another allies of mine. They appreciate the work I do, and they will make introductions for me. They will help explain what's going on, and they're just sort of, they're allies, and they're kind of like hubs, and they just sort of, I lean on them to
Do they expect anything in return from you?
You know, I usually can't write about them. I often think about why do sources talk to reporters?
Yes.
And it's a very good question.
I feel like we should do like a Supercuts show on this. And it's like the Supercuts show would be all journalists like, I have no idea why people, they're morons.
Yeah. Do I flatter myself by saying that I think because I'm always talking to a lot of people that like I'm kind of like a good like conduit for interesting thoughts on the industry.
Hmm.
Maybe that's helpful for them.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah.
Like you've got contacts at three companies.
I share
you
intel.
You share intel. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'll be like, here's what I'm hearing. Here's.
But you have to be careful not to reveal anything that would be clearly from one of the, like, okay, I'm at over here at internetworld.com.
Yeah.
I know Jimmy at webjazz.com.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so we're in the same field.
It's a $1 billion company. Do you,
And Nick and I are just going to, we're just going to spin off and do webjazz.com.
Let's do it.
Does Jimmy over at WebJazz know that I'm your source?
No.
So do any of your sources know about any
other
sources?
I mean, sometimes they'll surprise me and make me very uncomfortable by talking about things. Like sometimes I'll be out at a party and one will be right next to the other and they'll do this thing and I'm like, I'm holding my hands up right now saying like, this makes me uncomfortable. Bye. So
has anyone like burnt you before and like outed you as like a,
I don't know. I don't know how that would happen, but definitely I am often saying to people, cause they'll just casually be like, you know, this happened a lot for my book where it's like someone like, oh, you should definitely talk to so-and-so. Have you talked to so-and-so?
Right.
Just like they're trying to be helpful. Oh, you should go talk to the, you know, former CFO of Yahoo and you talk to this former CFO of Yahoo. And whether or not I have or not is a question that I cannot answer.
Yeah.
So I'll be like, I can't get into source. Yeah, and I can't,
it's good. Just kind of like a lot of nodding.
Yeah. I just sort of say like, I'll say something like, I just can't get into sourcing. It's a really good idea that I should talk to that person. Hopefully I will, you know?
So right now, how many sources do you have in the field?
Yeah, that's a tough question. It's like enough that they're very disorganized. You know, like I just have a lot. And so I'll have to like the today I published a story about the present that Google gave Google employees that a few of them were complaining about it.
Yeah.
They got new smartwatches and they're like, oh, these are so cheap. Or at least two of them were that I heard about. And so, you know, this is Friday evening. And I'm like, I got a hot tip.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, who are my Google sources?
So wait, who? Where did the hot tip come from?
It came
not
from
Google.
No, not from
not from Google.
Yeah,
okay.
not from Google. No.
Someone like heard someone on the BART talking about their
basically,
shitty ass watch.
Yeah, basically.
Has anyone had a tech career where they just sit on the BART and eavesdrop on people?
That's a good idea. You know, this is a whole other topic. I think it's hard to be a tech reporter in San Francisco because you're constantly surrounded by what's going on.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's news. It's oxygen to you.
All right. So you heard that there's some shitty watches.
So I just start Googling. I just start searching my inbox. Who have I ever talked to about Google? You know, like, and by the end, you know, come up with like, you know, 24 people to ask. But I need a spreadsheet that's like I can just type in like some when I want to talk about Google. Here are the people I talk to.
It's sort of like a CRM for sources.
I would love to have CRM. This is a good idea.
All right, that's what WebJazz is going to do.
WebJazz CRM for journalists, and we'll go out of business.
Okay, so like your new book is about Marissa Mayer and the, sort of the long saga of Yahoo.
Yeah.
Of your sources, would anyone's job be in danger if they were outed as a Nicholas Carlson source?
It is funny. So like I sent my book to Ken Auletta to be blurbed.
Yeah.
And he read it, and he was nice, and he did eventually blurb it. But before he did, he's like, okay.
He wrote a book about Google, like I was almost going to say in the 90s, but probably maybe.
I think it was like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah. Really? Like that short?
I think so. But he's written a lot of technology books.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So he said to me, like, I understand why when people are talking about state secrets, like they don't name any sources and why no one goes on the record. And he's like, well, why this is not on that order. Why are all these record people unnamed? And it's a really fair question. And so he said, you know, I explained to him, and he's like, okay, you need to put that in the note on sources, is that it's not like legal authority, but there is real power that belongs to someone like Marissa Mayer and Yahoo. They can make or break careers. And so in the end, what I really wanted to talk to people who, by the way, Marissa Mayer is a very you know, polarizing figure. And it's very easy to get people to say nasty things about her.
Right.
And I wanted to make sure that I got the very laudatory things as well. Like, why is she someone who people really admire out there? And that's speaking to her friends. And she was actively dissuading her friends from speaking to me. And so in the end, you know, you need someone who is friends with Marissa Mayer to say, okay, it is in her best interest, though she may not recognize it, for me to speak to you. But I'm not doing that if she knows that I spoke to you. So
did you, were you successful in breaking through, or can you not reveal
to
that?
To Marissa Mayer?
To her friend group.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Tell me how you pursue something like that.
So I have three emails I send. The first is just an email. I'm giving away all my secrets. But there's
this is the nature of this show.
Yeah.
Actually, after the show, we retire you and you're replaced by a younger man.
Exactly. Okay, so my first email is just it's a lot like that handshake I do at the end of a conference where I say, like, you know, I just need some education from you.
Yeah.
And then I send another one that's sort of like, and I say, like, I'm working on this project, but listen, it's going to be hard for me to explain over email. We'll get on the phone and off the record conversation.
Yeah.
I'll tell you more about my project and my point of view, because I found that people really want to know what your point of view is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can decide if you want to help me or not.
So I'm interested in that point of view
idea. Yeah, the secret is I don't have one.
Yeah, I was going to say. So you're Mayer. You started.
But people
this,
think you do.
What
so
became this book was like a 22,000 word piece on Mayer. So I'm assuming that like the original research for this book goes all the way back to that.
Yeah.
That piece,
mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how I would characterize it. This guy is indifferent to the fate of Yahoo. If Yahoo went out of business next, I don't think you would mourn it.
Right.
And if she pulls this off and it's bigger than Apple, I don't think you're going to be like, fuck yeah, like called it.
Yeah.
Like you're kind of, your attitude's like, and rightly so, is fairly neutral.
Yeah.
So how do you explain, how would you pitch that to someone as your attitude?
I try to just use plain English. I mean, I don't know. I try to say to him like, listen, here's my point of view. Well, no, there's easier ways you can do that. So I say, I'll say like, listen, I'll just start to talk about facts. I'll be like, listen, she's very polarizing.
Mm-hmm.
People think she's awkward in these ways, and she has her enemies, and they are her enemies for these reasons.
Yeah.
And I'm going to reflect that in the book. On the other hand, you know, she became this star executive at Google, and she's, you know, for people who this means something to them, she's worth $300 million. So you don't just, that doesn't usually happen just totally by accident. You know, like there's something you've accomplished there. She positioned herself into this job. So there's obviously something to admire. Like she's an impressive person. And by the way, she has lots of people who swear by her. She has a group of people who think she is amazing. So they must see something in her. So I just say to them, like, look, what I'm interested in is finding out both sides and really kind of like triangulating down to which one is the reality, you know, where in between there's a reality. And so when I say that to people, most people are reasonable and they say, okay, let's do this thing. Now, often when this, when the third email comes in, often they'll be like, I'm still nervous. I don't really want to. And that's when I send the guilt trippy email.
Hmm.
I send them an email and I say that this, I realized I needed to do this eventually. You have to actually persuade sources to talk to you. You can't just expect them to want to, because why would they want to?
So I'll say it's against their interests.
Yeah, there is actually very little reason to. So you have to give them a reason to. And there are good reasons. They just, you know, they're sort of altruistic in some ways. And I say, it's a good deed. So the reason you should speak to me is that it's a good deed. It's a good deed to Marissa because she is elected not to participate in this. So there is, she literally does not have a spokesperson.
And conversely, if you're about to fry her, you're like, people need to know the truth about her.
You know, I'm like, it takes very little persuasion for people who are going to fry her. I don't really have to convince them much.
What if people's objection is like, I could lose my job, or like it would endanger my friendship to her to do it?
Then I start talking about, okay, tell me stories where there were more than you, just you and her in the room.
Okay.
You know, tell me stories where anybody who knows this will not be able to immediately identify you. I am seriously not looking to get anybody in trouble. So.
There's a scene that's in your book, and I think it's also in the New York Times Magazine excerpt, where basically they're doing a performance review of someone among the Yahoo executives.
Right.
And someone's like, fuck, I don't like that guy. He's super annoying. And then that guy like leaves it's like another executive leaves the company.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many people were there at the performance reviews.
Yeah.
What, 10 maybe?
Yeah. Like, I appreciate those.
Has
sources.
Anyone ever like, you know, like done a, like, you know, like a mystery style reconstruction? Like I can eliminate this person and this person.
That's another reason why in this book, you'll notice that I didn't do a lot of like the thing where you like jump out of the narrative real quick and you get to someone who's like a commentator, like a color commentator on the story. And I don't do a lot of that, even with sources that maybe would be willing to do a quote, because I don't want to. And this is another thing I got from James Stewart. Was I don't want to allow for process of elimination, people to start figuring out, okay, well, this person gave a quote here, so that means they're definitely talking, you know, that sort of thing.
I mean, like, I just know even in things that are, like, totally petty, like, someone I know worked at a company, like a creative company, and that company got a very bad review on Glassdoor.
Oh.
And basically the entire company, like the entire executive team of this company organized not to address the complaints of the employee, but through pretty deep detective work, figuring out who had posted it and tried to get them to take it down, getting down to like two or three people, got the wrong person and fired them.
Oh, God.
And that wasn't even at a large company. That was at, let's say, a 200 or 300 person company.
I mean, God forbid they like actually try to listen to what the story says.
And the complaint was basically no one gets promoted from within to the executive ranks, which is like a hilarious reaction.
So they
they're like, all right, we got to stand together on this one. Yeah. Squatch.
This is a clear us against them scenario.
But the stakes are really high here with Yahoo. It's a publicly traded company.
Yeah.
And people's careers are at stake.
Right.
So I imagine that people would go.
Well, I'm glad you appreciate the gravity. I mean, this is why I was so careful with, like, you know, using no names. I get that it's sometimes a leap for some people. They're like, oh, why do you?
Right. I mean, I guess I wasn't like inclined to kick holes in it because I didn't find any of it. I wasn't like, no way did that happen.
Right.
Well, it's ultimately believable.
Yeah.
But I guess I wonder, like, when you start thinking about people losing their jobs, et cetera, or I was thinking in the context of this, you know, this Times Magazine story, this will have actually happened, so we can gamble on it right now if you want.
Yeah.
Is this going to send the stock up or down?
That's a good question. You know, I mean, I don't know. I have no idea.
Like, I would guess, I mean, the New York Times, I think, is still a large enough part of American life that if you do, this is a cover story on the Times Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever conclusion people draw about this, I would guess will cause people to react in the market.
It's a funny story because it may cause negative sentiment about Marissa Meyer. And we can get into like the nuances of the story, but like it may cause people to think, oh, well, her efforts turnaround are not working. But here's the thing, though, like baked into that is also this argument that, okay, well, that means it's other transactions probably going to happen.
Right.
Where a lot of cash is coming shareholders' way. And when cash, I mean, like, so like almost the whole funny thing with Yahoo is that as this turnaround has not happened.
Yeah.
The stock price has gone through the roof.
Yes.
So that's why it's sort of hard to sort of say.
Like I was wondering, like, since I have an advance of this and the book, whether like almost like if I were to take a strong position on Yahoo right now, that would be considered insider trading. But the problem is I'm not above that at all.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell which position to take, which like, I think speaks to your the way that you represented your intentions, where I was like, well, there's some really negative things in there.
Yeah.
On the other hand, like if they shed this Alibaba money and it's a much smaller business, well, that business could double itself much more easily.
That's totally true.
Like, it becomes more volatile. Yeah. Maybe that's good. Also, like, I assume that people just see the word Yahoo and that might send the stock up. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, oh, Yahoo, that still exists.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, wow, they got a cover story?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Something was
great PR. No, funny thing about the Marissa Meyers, I wrote that one. And they, like, their reaction to it was silence. And I'm glad you thought it was fair, because I think most people did, but that's great. So that was my intention. AOL, the comms guy there, and Tim Armstrong read that story and said, wow, Yahoo PR did it. Like, that was a good job by them, working with you on this story.
Yeah. that's a, like a unanimous, like I, since I'm not a journalist, but I like talk to journalists and I talk to people who have like been on the like receiving end of journalism.
Yeah.
Like generally the people who are like covered are like, you really fucked us over. Like we look terrible. And everyone else is like, so you're on their payroll, right? Like that is, I would say that is the like prototypical response to a fair business
I've
story.
I've heard this on your podcast a number of times when journalists are like, no one likes being written about.
One likes being written about.
Yeah.
So knowing that Yahoo was not going to like being written about in this context, the book takes several key moments in the history of Yahoo, and I would say a lot of your stories about this. Like, if I were to describe, you have a series of stories for Business Insider. It's like how Larry Page turned Google, or you know, turned Google around, or like how a bunch of kids from eBay like made a new eBay. Right? It's usually like a company in a moment of transition or transformation. Mm-hmm. That seems to be like what interests you as a reporter.
Yeah.
Some of these calls that get made in these companies, like buying Tumblr, say, right? You can have someone who's like, that was the fucking bungle of the decade. And you can have someone be like, that's how you know that's Marissa Meyer.
Yeah.
That's her genius, right? So I guess I wonder, like, do you make that call?
Yeah,
like,
that's a really good question.
Because you're not that's what an analyst does.
Yeah,
an analyst goes like, that was smart or that was stupid.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think that they do so with any deep, like, I don't know, like, I kind of follow Apple closely.
Yeah.
Whenever I read, like, an Apple analyst, and I'm like, I'm like, that is basically just like reading the news and like pontificating about it.
You know what I think it is? I think that if Yahoo goes one way or goes the other way, I won't really care. That's probably true. I mean, it's definitely true. I'm also comfortable with ambiguity. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I'm just going to tell you what the latest is with Tumblr. And I'm not necessarily going to draw a fine point to say this is the truth about, like, here's the one sentence that, like, summarizes the whole thing.
Right.
I may say, like, this is the deal now. This is a challenging thing was ending this book because it's live.
Right. I know. I was thinking about that, too. What day, when does it come out?
It comes out January 6th, but I finished writing it August 18th.
The real irony is if your New York Times story, which comes out before the book, like sends like Yahoo into either like a tailspin or a spike and it makes your book outdated, that would be deeply ironic.
That would be a horrible, horrible fate.
So there are clear narratives like Steve Jobs came back to Apple and turned things around.
Mm-hmm.
iPod revolutionized the industry.
Yeah.
Okay, that's or Patch with AOL was like a bunk. Okay, so it's like no one in a business book was going to be like, and then they had a great idea. They'd start a network of local blogs and it would change the world, right? Those are like canon business decisions.
It's impossible to be ambiguous about those, though.
So I guess I'm wondering, like, as someone who's been in the game
yeah.
for 6 years plus, how much time do you need for something to be canon? Like how quickly will we be able to judge Marissa Meyer or judge these decisions that are happening right now?
Well, I think a way to answer this question is that occasionally you do need to, like, we got a hold of Patch Numbers a couple years before it was shut down. Mm-hmm. And I said, I think my headline was, we've seen Patch revenue numbers for 2000, whatever. And it makes us worried that Tim Armstrong doesn't know how to run AOL. And that's a call. And sometimes you have to make a big call. And, you know, it's a little bit like that old columnist thing, you know, make a big swing to get attention so people will read. Sometimes you just got to go for that. And I don't know, that's just the, like, conviction strikes you and you just go for it. I've also been wrong before when things like that.
You talk about the Steve Jobs worship that sort of animates the tech industry right now. No one can run a company without being the new Steve Jobs or aspiring to be. I was saying about this Marissa Meyer, but then I realized actually you also wrote a story about Jack Dorsey from Twitter a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. Also about, is Jack Dorsey positioning himself as the new Steve Jobs? It sort of cuts both ways where it's, The reporter is asking if they are the new Steve Jobs.
We love it.
And also the person is interrogated for trying too hard to be like Steve Jobs in many situations. So I guess it strikes me that the media is partially responsible for the, like, movie version of business.
Yeah.
And now it's like it's come a little full circle and, like, it's in people's heads.
But the funny parallel between Jack Dorsey and Marissa Meyer is that both were, like, on this, like, up and up and up trajectory where the press was treating them so well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were giving interviews everywhere all the time. I mean, Jack Dorsey was being treated. I mean, literally, it was journalists who said, journalists and an Apple employee, you know, early Apple employees said, this guy is the next Steve Jobs. I mean, it was those people who are saying it, and they were getting treated so well. And then what happens is just, you know, the hype gets so far blown that somebody else comes in with a little, like, pin and just pops it, and then it just gets terrible for them. And now Jack Dorsey doesn't give interviews very much. He just gave one to the Times, but and Marissa Meyer doesn't give interviews much anymore because they start to see, like, it never was about me. They start to realize that the press was just using them before and is now using them again as, like, sort of characters that they know about. And they sort of almost a little bit wise up. I mean, it's a circle back to sources. Like, why are you going to be a source? And so they start to realize, I don't need this, and this is awful, and I don't want it anymore.
It makes sense that they would wise up, and that's sort of part of the maturing process is sort of controlling your own story and your own destiny. For the reporter, like, the Steve Jobs myth is both sides are sort of perpetuating it. You can't totally let it go because you have to continue to write stories about this stuff. And I think that at its core, the Steve Jobs myth is about the great heroic individual who changes the face of a company through sheer will.
Yeah.
And it suggests that personal character and quotes that you could put on a coffee mug are very important to business, right? The most important thing to becoming a business person is, like, a quote that would be misattributed to Picasso.
It's the crazy ones. Right. Here's to the crazy ones.
Here's to the crazy ones.
Right. I mean, he was marketing himself. That ad came out before they had any good products again. It was like, I'm back.
Right. You know? So in building a book like this that's both a dry autopsy in motion of Yahoo and is also a portrait of the person running Yahoo now, how do you balance the numerical and human
blurb,
star?
By the way,
a moving autopsy. Aaron Lammer from webjazz.com. How do you balance the sort of raw numerical understanding of, like, where Yahoo's at versus someone like Marissa Meyer? And this comes up in almost every story. You could write a dry analytical story about Google, or you could write about the hopes and visions of Larry Page. And I think it's no accident that most of these companies of that scale have that kind of a hero figure. Larry Page, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos. You almost can't have a company of this size and not have a figure like
that. What begins to happen is, so you're sitting there and you want to say, this person totally fucked up. And you can't just say that. You have to say how. And so you have to explain how Yahoo's decision to not integrate their search ad business and their search, like, algorithmic natural, you know, search product into one allowed it to just be totally destroyed by Google.
Yeah.
And so then you have to say, okay, why and how. And that's a whole different kind of writing, and, you know, where I sort of try as best as possible to sort of simplify and explain in plain English, like, the intricacies of the search business. And mm-hmm. it's very fun. It's very different, but it's very fun.
If I came to you after reading one of your stories, I could react to what you just described, sort of the like analytical process behind these business decisions, or I could respond to Marissa Meyer. She loves like luxury mm-hmm. clothing. That's like how, that's what I got. Yeah. I got out of it the personal stuff. Is one more true than the other? Is one more validating? Like, which do you feel like gets closer to understanding what's going on?
I mean, to me, like, I think people are what's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I like writing about, I mean, Marissa Meyer is like a once-in-a-lifetime subject. I mean,
Yeah.
But listen, she's like full of contradictions. She's like this woman who, you know, appears in Vogue and yeah. looks so amazingly coiffed, but then when she's got the most important meeting of like her first year at Yahoo, she shows up on stage and her hair is wet. And she, you know, she seems on stage, she's incredibly great at connecting to like an interviewer or an yeah. audience. But then in a conference room, she won't look you in the eye and is cold and is like, you know, unempathetic. And I'm just like, this lady is like really, really interesting. I'd like to write about her. And so to me, that's the driving interest. There's a million business stories.
Yeah.
But I think if you don't have that character at the center, then you're lost. And it's not as fun for me. Like, you know, like, to be honest, the Larry Page story I wrote last year, it was kind of a drag to write. I mean, I did get to like the stuff where he's kind of got this weird vision for the future.
Yeah.
But Larry Page is who he seems to be.
Interesting.
You know?
Personally,
yeah.
I'm like, all of these people are kind of boring. Like, actually, like, what I took from your book was like, some of these product decisions were pretty interesting. Like, it was a pretty interesting, like, people were making bigger moves on the web in the day, like mm-hmm. when it was actually seemed like one website might just be the internet. You yeah. know, I was like, these decisions are huge. Like, weird shit AOL and Yahoo decided in 2000
yeah.
or 1998.
Yeah.
Really affected what we perceive as the internet.
Yeah.
Whereas I was like, these people are all kind of, I mean, I know they think that they're important and they sort of live like people who've yeah. decided early that their lives were important.
Okay.
But it's like the unifying thread I see it as they're like, it's no surprise that like cryogenics is a big focus among like the ultra rich.
So
like, yeah. It doesn't.
Yeah. They're achievers, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a very specific vision of what a great person is
yeah.
that doesn't seem like it came from them. It seems like an external idea of what
sure.
a great person
ambition.
Is.
It's this whole, that's an interesting topic is ambition and how they all, yeah. I mean, I think Marissa Meyer is, I mean, like she's fabulously wealthy at this point. She does not need to be, almost like, it's almost cliche at this point to talk about a techie executive and say they don't need to be working.
Yeah.
Like, none of them need to be working. And so what are they working for? They work really crazy hours, by the way, and they work really hard. And so what for?
I mean, are you ever inspired to do like a story that's like the flip side? Like he made $200 million and then he did not do anything. I guess that's kind of like the Steve Wozniak story.
Yeah.
It's just like.
And then he was on reality TV.
Yeah, just like hanging out, like being a slob that
yeah.
people love.
Yeah. I mean, maybe.
So you told me a little bit like mm-hmm. about in Valley Wag, the yeah. idea of having like the soul suckiness. Like how's your soul doing now?
My soul's good. It's much better than it was after Valley Wag. That took a little while. I feel like I got to have a lot of the fun at Business Insider that I had at Valley Wag and
yeah.
without a lot of the just nastiness. I had these nightmares as I was coming off my book leave that I would be going back to Business Insider of 2010, where there was, you know, 10 of us, and it was crank all the time.
He's talking about crystal methamphetamine.
Yeah, we were all on crank. Have you met Joe Wiesenthal?
Yeah.
That explains everything, I think. No, but then I came back, and I actually, like, I lurched into it. I, like, lurched into, like, blogging a lot, kind of a little bit, just as I got back. And, like, Henry pulled me aside. He's like, you don't need to do that.
Yeah.
Like, just resist the temptation, just post. And so that has been it's been nice. And I mean, it's also, then you're sitting there like, well, what are I write about? But anyway, so no, I mean, my soul's great.
Does the experience of going from crank
to like a slower drug, you know, like working longer on pieces. What has that done for your writing? I mean, is it hard to transition back into like getting sent, like getting like edited at a sentence level and, and having people look at what you're posting before you post it and revise and stuff? Like, what does that do to the brain?
It's fair to say that I will end up at 1,000 words faster than ever before. When you're writing a book, you get in context, you explain context. Mm-hmm. You need to. You're creating a world and you're like, okay, like it's like before, like if I'm going to talk about why this decision about to not merge the two sides of the search business was disastrous for Yahoo, well, I need to explain to you what the search business is and how search advertising works. But at BI, if I'm going to do a quick post on Yahoo's new deal with Firefox or even just like, I don't know, anything. I don't need to explain to you how the search business works.
Right.
So coming back, I was like still explaining how the search business works. And I was like, I don't need to back that far up. I can just start here and maybe I'll go back to like linking to something if someone needs to really know. Or they can just go to Google.
I would put Business Insider in a class of publishers that, you know, also includes people like BuzzFeed and people who like came out of the gate with a sort of very specific negative connotation to some people of being a factory of kinds. And both have undergone, I think, something of a renaissance in how they're perceived and the quality of the work they're putting out, where you see, you know, Joe Weisenthal is going on TV now. Yeah. That is not an outcome I would have bet on in 2010. You know, and BuzzFeed has like a investigative journalism vertical. And a lot of times when I talk to people, both from the outside and the inside, from the outside, people have sort of a notion of them that's sort of locked in time. And from the inside, there's this like perpetual chip on the shoulder where it's like, it doesn't matter if you want like the magazine, like wins the wins a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
You're still kind of like pissed off about people's perception of you.
Yeah.
Does that affect your work, and do you think about that when you're writing for Business Insider?
So I've had the opportunity. I've been there 6 years. And I think that says a lot. I've had the opportunity to go other places. I just did this New York Times Magazine story, and it's been very enlightening. I love BI, and I know that the brand is not like esteemed. It's not like a lot of journalists are very credential oriented. Like they're like, well, I work for the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
And there's a column of pros and cons, and BI's brand, while I think it's improving, is a con compared to other business publications from Fortune to Forbes to the Wall Street Journal to, I mean, like to Vanity Fair and the New Yorker, all these wonderful places to work. I just sort of look at the advantages of being there and I think this is great. And so I'm just happy to be telling stories there.
Do those cons affect like how you do your job? Like,
yeah,
I assume that if you were at the Wall Street Journal and you're like, hey, guy at a conference, I write for the Wall Street Journal. That guy's like, I definitely want to have a drink with you. If you're like Business Insider, it's like, who's paying?
So that is 100% a thing that happens, although it's changed.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely now people are more excited to be a part of us and, you know, from sourcing and things like that. And then I also, I mean, we don't get the call from the M&A banker who's wanting to float a deal to see, you know, on background to see how it moves one stock or the other. You know,
right.
They're called trial balloons. We don't really get those yet. We're working on it. We'd like to. M&A bankers who listen to long form, listen.
There's at most one of them.
We are your shop.
Yeah.
That's the one that will help us, though.
Yeah. Okay. You know, you heard it here first. He's having a son and he's interested in some weird stock manipulation stuff.
Exactly. I'm your guy for the non-public information.
Wadget isn't getting all kinds of like weird offers. That doesn't seem quite add up.
But that's changed.
Yeah.
But I did have fun with the Times Magazine story, finally being like, so I'm working on a magazine story with the New York Times.
Right. And do you now get to say, like, you know, he's written for Business Insider and the New York Times Magazine?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Actually, I've only been in print now twice.
Yeah.
The first time was also for the New York Times Magazine. I did, like, a very short freelancing thing for them about, speaking of press releases, that was, like, a story about Columbia's, like, journalists learning how to hack, like, being
hacks and hackers.
You know, it's just like, so what's your program like? You know, and they tell you, okay, write it down. It's like, but I did that just because of the brand, but it was a freelance assignment. So
the state of Silicon Valley, like, doesn't seem totally sustainable. I'm not the only person saying this.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like we're in some sort of a transitional period, yeah. whether it's a bubble or I think bubble is the wrong way to think about it, but yeah. simply from a technological standpoint, things are evolving so rapidly yeah. that the business can't stay the same. Is this something that you want to like follow for life, or do you think about jumping ship and going somewhere else with yeah. your interests?
No, so I think I, you know, like I am fascinated by business and I'm fascinated by technology, but I think first and foremost, I'm like, I like to tell stories. That's, yeah. that's the main thing. Again, shorts, do those short stories someday.
Yeah.
Damn it. No.
Yeah, how are those going? I mean, do you still write
no.
short stories?
No, I mean, I think that these are they. You know yeah. what I mean? Like I learned like narrative from this guy named Douglas Glover. I thank him in the book. He taught me that like narrative and plot is a physical object. This part goes here, this part goes here, this part goes there. And I just have taken that framework and instead of making up facts, I have like taken real facts. And so I'm doing that. Someday maybe I'll go do research and then get into people's lives and find the dramatic things and then not use their real names and change one or two details and then call that a short story or a novel and it'll be, you know, anyway, five people will read it and I'll be thrilled.
Are you ever tempted to, I know there's been a few prominent technology writers who've switched sides in the last few years.
I'm not tempted by PR.
I like your clarity. Okay, so you're having a child.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you, sir. I
appreciate
so cool.
you bringing. Like, we don't get a lot of exclusives on this show. How do you think you're going to explain this period of time to your
wow,
child?
Wow, these are great questions. See, like,
it's going to be like hard. It's going to be hard to even like. This is going to be like you were involved in some weird cultish shit.
Yeah.
In the teens, right? Like,
yeah.
you're going to be like a guy, I don't know, like how, like
Daddy once wrote a book.
Yeah. How do you think, because, I mean, I guess the other thing is that this book is going to be dated in
yeah.
like 6 months.
I know.
But like.
You don't think it'll be a classic? No, just kidding.
No, I mean, like, more, like it's going to be like the kind of thing where there's going to be a resolution on
yeah.
it. I mean, I think it's a great book, like it's a great holiday gift, but. I mean, I guess you can keep like doing like updated appendix. And it's true that like Liar's Poker is not about the present day and it's still very fascinating to people.
Yeah, someone was joking with me, and next one will be called, it'll be a sequel, and it'll be Marissa Meyer, Girl on Fire, or something. Like, or was it like the Mockingjay or something?
Yeah. So like, yeah, what would you tell him about this period of time and what you were up to?
Well, I'll be like,
I don't know why I said him. Like, so I'll could be a woman.
Yeah, exactly. Daughter, take off the virtual reality headset.
Yeah.
Come back to the flesh world. I have something to say to you. Yeah. Or actually, we'll just be like communicating inside VR.
Yeah.
And she'll have some sort of like transgendered alien avatar.
Right.
And we'll be speaking about the flesh world.
Yeah.
And no, actually, I don't know. But I actually am I get made fun of this. I am sort of like a little bit of a techno-utopian.
Yeah.
Like it's... I do think, well, I don't know if it's all utopian. I definitely do think that there are going to be like crazy advances in technology and that they're not stopping and that everything is changing and it's going to like make our brains hurt and like things like, you know, family and nationality and race and creed might all be pushed to the side and changed. And
right. It's weird. I think I share that with you.
Yeah.
Like, and I get myself in trouble also. I mean, I think you're like, it's a little more justified for you because you're like, man, if you weren't a little bit like optimistic or utopian about this stuff, your job would be a grind. So I don't really have an excuse.
But there are some who are like that. I've only read the description of Matt Honan's interview on Long Form.
But
apparently he likes just tearing it all down all the time.
Yeah, but he's also like hanging around for the show.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
But like, I guess my question is like, so I'm also a little, like, I think I lean a little utopian, yeah. idealistic towards it. Possibly just because I'm kind of like hoping for that, mm-hmm. like that version. But I find that when I engage in that, it has to be kind of like ethics free. Like it's almost like it's happening. Like who cares if it's good or bad? Like you don't say if it's good or bad.
There's a lot of bad stuff. I mean, like it'll be, by the way, it'll be all those things with ads.
You know? Right. And that's the kind of weird part is like when people are like, I'm like, Uber's so interesting, and people are like, Uber's so fucked up. And I'm like, oh, I hadn't really thought about whether it was fucked up or not when I said that. Which is kind of what you said about writing this book, which is like, I can't really take a stand on pro or against Yahoo or these business decisions. Like, do you ever have like an internal moral or ethical compass that you turn off while you're doing this?
It's funny that this is probably an advantage. yeah. for the things I do. But I don't like have a firm stand on a lot of things. I was talking about this with my wife, but maybe my firm stand is that things are nuanced.
Right. The world is complicated.
Like things are, I am a moderate and I see your point on this.
Yeah.
But we could still talk about things like Ferguson and Michael Brown by the way, Black Lives Matter, awful things that happened, complete tragedies, but I'm not the person on the street waving the flag because I can't, like, I'll sit there and I can't just take the total stance and say, like, I'm on Team X and I believe this list of things, period.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm just not that person.
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
But I'm always like, what would something cause me, you know? Like,
I
maybe
so.
It's because sometimes with this technology stuff, I'm like, I don't have a strong stand on this.
How do you feel about Newtown? Like, I was like, guns are stupid as shit.
No, it's true. Like, I feel stronger about gun control than I feel about the regulation of the taxi cab industry, you know? And
yes,
I think
that's
a defensible
right.
point. And it's almost like I don't want to use up my outrage on like people wearing Google Glass in bars, you know? Like
that's a really good point. Yeah.
It's like, I feel like I have to conserve it. But that's the weird thing about the technology industry is like tech it'll make you feel like a curmudgeon if you feel anything but being a utopian in a way. And I think at my life at some point I'm going to like turn the corner.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to be like angry at everything and I'm going to be like not into it. Cause that's like my father does not have a cell phone.
Wow.
He was like a dude out in the 70s, like following the Grateful Dead.
Wow.
Like he was doing his thing. Yeah. I think at a certain point he was just like, fuck this shit.
Yeah.
Like
that's the dream, man.
I'm not like, I'm into some things of this era.
I do have that dream.
And then he like stopped at a certain era.
I do a little bit have that dream of just like, unplugging, just being.
Yeah. I mean, does that
take
like
the phone out of my pocket? And
I guess
never put it back.
We both. You have a stronger real reason for me that is like you. If you like really, really hated this stuff and really had to unplug, you'd be unemployed.
Yeah, I would. I would. I need to be around it. It's like, it's the input, and then I turn it into output. So the input's got to keep going in. There's things you can turn off. Like I stop following certain people on Twitter, or I'll like just.
Do you have any mentors or like contact with the kind of like OGs of the tech journalism game, you know, like Stephen Levy and these guys who've been in it for a long time? There aren't many of them. I mean, those guys are still only what, like in their late 40s?
No, Stephen's great.
People who are covering it?
I definitely keep up with Stephen for sure. Brad Stone, Peter Kafka, Kara Swisher. Kara Swisher.
Is there a lot of burnout? I mean, it doesn't seem like a lot of people like last multiple decades in technology
reporting. That is the interesting
thing.
That's the thing that like Kara told me. I was like, how are you so great? She's like, I've just been around a long time.
Yeah. Is that like your strategy just like outlast
everyone?
It seems
to work. It's like the bylines have just faded.
Yeah.
Like people go, I'm still here. And I'm like, what, 32? Yeah. So I'm like, what? Like, I don't know. No, but it's been 6 years at BI and then a year at ValleyWag and then 2 years at Internet News. And I'm like, definitely the old man.
You could be the Steve Jobs of Internet News.
I could
go back and turn that place around.
We're going to drop the .com.
Yeah.
That's the big call.
Yeah. That's the scene in the movie where you come in. You're like, guys. All right. Well, that feels like as good a place to start as any. Thank you very much, Nicholas Carlson.
This is a dream of mine.
Tell me what the book is. The book is called and when it's going to be on the newsstand.
Marissa Meyer and the Fight to Save Yahoo. It'll be on bookshelves and Amazon and everything January 6th.
And if you want a little preview of it, check out New York Times Magazine. There's a really nice sort of adapted piece from it.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week. And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to my guest, Nicholas Carlson. Thanks to our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman. My co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thanks to our intern, Rachel Mabe. If you got a new iPhone or iPad for Christmas, maybe you'd like to put the Long Form app on it. It's totally free. We really encourage you to check it out. It's chock full of writers who've been on this show. You can follow them. You can share articles you're loving with your friends, or you can take on a flight and have a whole flight's worth of entertainment without spending a nickel. Let me know what you think of it. Aaron at longform.org, or leave a review at iTunes. Be back here next week.